You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 316, Doctor Who regenerates into a woman. Woo-wee-oo. Men on internet forums weep into their pillows. Oh no! Radiohead play in Israel. Ken Loach says they are standing with an oppressor. Is he right? And maybe it's time to make a radical decision on the future of the Notting Hill Carnival. It's all coming up after Young MC and Know How.
Rhymes ever made by man are going into this mic written by this hand, are coming out of this mouth made by this tongue. I tell you now, my man, my name is Young. But so you think that it's your destiny to get the best of me, but I suggest to be quiet, bro, don't even try it. From the east and west of me, taking it and never breaking it, or even shaking it, grooving it and always moving it, cause I'm not faking it. Pulling out rhymes like books off the shelf, born in England, raised in Holland, taught to go for myself. This is stone cold rhyming, no frills, no fluffs, and it's no accident that these rhymes sound tough. I'm going off, baby, there's no turning back. I'm on your TV, on your album, cassette, and 8-track. And when the show is finally finished, I'll be taking my bow. My name is Jungle, yo, I got no how. You know what I'm saying? I got juice like the president, I'm making rappers hesitant. Invite me to your house and I'll be chilling like a resident. Yes, cause I'm that type of man, cause I make myself at home no matter where I am. I got it rolling like thunder, making y'all wonder why I'm on top with all the other rappers under. I make no errors, mistakes or blunders. It's like a wedding, let no man put us under. My name is Young and see I like to rock right well, cause when I get up on the mic I just release my spell. It's no hocus pocus, I just get you into focus and swarm all over you just like a horde of locusts. Smooth operator, female persuader, spot a fly girl and in a week I'm on a dater. I got the kind of style for the here and the now, and I can do it cause I got no how. You know what I'm saying? I got no hat. Party people, I got no hat. Bust it. Cause I know what I'm doing. I treat them like double mint gum and start chewing. I spit them out when the flavor's gone, and I repeat the chewing process till the break of dawn. Cause I'm tough like a bone, sly like Stallone, rocking and clocking on the microphone. Smooth like a mirror and hearts that strike terror. Rhymes like runs and hits with no errors. Cold like a blizzard on the mic, I am the wizard with the funky fresh rhymes coming out of my gizzard. Never sneezing, never coughing, I rock the mic often. Hard as a rock and no sign I'll soften, making sure I get respect on my mind. Rhymes connect, I start to build like a builder from an architect. Moving all around, above and under the grind, you see my face and then you hear my sound coming at ya with the mic in hand. I'm gonna take command just the way I plan, cause I'm a one man band and you are my fan. Don't you understand, I'm like Superman. You're the man of steel, don't you know the deal. You better be for real, I got sex appeal. This is what I feel and this here's my vow. And now you know the brother with no how. You know what I'm saying? I got no how, and I'm chilling, never illing. In my mouth I got two feelings. Whatever, I'm on a mic, cold stone hitting over. My name is Young MC, known as the Fly Casanova. Kick it.
One of those singles that you hear everywhere, I convinced myself it was a major hit. But in fact, number 95 only in the UK charts. Indeed, yeah. In 1988 for Young MC and Know How.
Yes, I assumed that was much bigger than it was.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends.
It's... yes, please make it end. Please. I've been here in my pyjamas for days.
It's the podcast from the Parish Council. This is episode 316. I'm Terence Stackham, and I looked for her name on the list of the highest paid UK radio presenters this week. Sadly missing from that list is Juliet Harris.
I know, it's a scandal, really. It might be something to do with the fact that I don't work for the BBC, which seems a bit incidental, but anyway, never mind. Hello, everyone.
Juliet, when I was young and the world was in black and white...
I was going to say wibbly-wobbly, 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 yeah.
There was one sound that came from the television on a Saturday evening that was guaranteed to ensure my mother came hurtling into the room to turn the television off, and that sound was... Dun, 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 dun. It was the opening music for Doctor Who in the 1960s. The opening music was all I experienced. My mother came in, switched it over, saving me from potential nightmares, and with the best of intentions, no doubt. But this meant that I never experienced the alternative world of the TARDIS, Daleks and ever-changing Doctors.
The Cybermen, yep.
All of that. In the 80s, the programme faded away, but then a reboot in 2005 has been massively successful. I've still never seen an episode, but this week it was announced that for the first time a woman, Jodie Whittaker, has been cast into the lead role. Now, Jules, why should I be excited about, and I'm sorry about this, Jodie, an actress I've never heard of playing in a show I've never watched?
Well, I mean, I could go at you all. On this and say
you often would. Yeah.
Why should I be interested? You say you know the fact that you have taken no interest in something is, I suspect, a fault of yours rather than a fault of anything else.
I thought I thought everybody should sort of fall in with my lifestyle.
Well, and so you know, I do want to gently kind of chastise this. Having said that, though, I'll treat your inquiry as legitimate on this occasion. So I do think it is quite important, actually, because I hoped there would be a woman, and I had insider information that they were trying very hard to get a woman.
Right.
It makes sense that it is Jodie Whittaker in the circumstances, because the chap that now runs Doctor Who, who's taking over as the showrunner, is a guy called Chris Chibnall, who wrote something, who's famous for doing something, lots of things, but ostensibly something called Broadchurch.
Oh, okay.
ITV, which is a very... I know that the reason that you haven't heard of Jodie Whittaker, I suspect, because you've not watched that.
I haven't.
She had a very prominent role in that. That was a very successful drama series on ITV. And quite often, showrunners tend to take in people that they've kind of worked with previously, hence Russell T. Davis and David Tennant, for example. Doctor Who has enormous ratings. It does, as you say, it's been extremely successful, the reboot. I would go as far as to say that it has been successful to the point where it's obviously a big cash cow for the BBC around the world, and I would go as far to say, because it has been going on for so long, and when it was rebooted, it was rebooted with real affection, I think, and really welcomed back. I think it is, not necessarily the most important thing ever, but I think it is an important part of British cultural life. If we're saying that television is an important part of British cultural life, which I really think it is, then in a multi-channel world, the fact that it can still hook in relatively big ratings suggests to me that it is an important part of British cultural life. And I'm therefore, as a feminist, and as someone that is a young woman that is, you know, fed up with the world being increasingly again tooled around older white men, apologies Terence, if only it was tooled around you, at least you're one of the good ones, but my view is that actually to have a young woman a youngish woman doing this role, she's only 3 years older than me, to do this role, I think it's really important and really encouraging. I think it's fantastic for young girls, a great role model. There's been a great moral panic amongst some institutions, and also amongst some unfortunate men who are big Doctor Who fans, who have now turned around and said they won't watch the show again ever because it's
ruined. God.
I can't believe that a show about a multi-regenerating alien from space lacks realism, by the way. But they've obviously missed the point of the show anyway, I feel, which is about regeneration and reforms and new forms, I think. Also, this ridiculous idea that men... You know, young boys lack role models. It's like, for God's sake, everybody in British public life. Yes, we have Mrs. May as Prime Minister, although for how long, who knows? And I suspect she'll be replaced by a white man, be it of a blue persuasion or a red persuasion. You know, I think it is important, and I think it's great that you know, there is this role model for young girls now. There was that lovely footage that went viral around the world on Twitter of that girl excitedly reacting to the announcement that she was a woman, and that Doctor Who would be a woman, and she was just so pleased. Now, I think it's great, and you know, as someone that is increasingly frustrated by the marginalised, you know, how women are marginalised, particularly this week, the story from the BBC, we haven't picked this as a topic. this week, but we've had this you know, the BBC being forced to, as part of its charter renewal, to reveal which of its stars are on very high pay, and it would seem that it's revealed a huge discrepancy between men and women doing similar roles. And indeed, there's a letter published in the Telegraph today, signed by a pretty
everybody at the top echelon. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you know, newsreaders, radio four presenters, Claire Balding, you know, all sorts of people have signed it. And so, in a way, I am, you know, we are still not there with equality between men and women in society. I'd hate to say it, but, you know, equal pay, I think, is an extremely important indicator of how you value people and how you reflect people's worth. So actually, I do think it is important that such a prominent role is now a woman rather than a man. I'm sorry that there was an outcry / big reaction to it. It would be lovely if, you know, one day there isn't a reaction to it and it is just normal. So actually, I do think it is important. And to go back to my slightly snippy comment at the beginning, I can kind of see why this might pass you by a bit. And we have talked about this previously. And when we had to go back to a point I made during the conversation we had about Justine Greening and that incident that she had. Maybe, and again, I don't want to sound, you know, discourteous, maybe this doesn't mean a lot to you because it's not really about you if you're a white, an older white guy. Maybe it's more important for those of us, you know, who are, you know, women who are feminists that constantly, and also young girls that need better role models. Maybe this has passed you by because you don't watch the show, and maybe it's not. It's not your. Maybe you don't have a horse in the race. I don't know.
Yeah, that's certainly very true. I mean, by the way, hats off to Jane.
No, I mean that with every respect, by the way.
It's very fair point. Hats off to Jane Garvey for organising the sort of revolt against this domination pay for men in the radio.
It's ridiculous. When you look at the highest paid man was Chris Evans on something like 2.2 million, and the highest paid woman, Alex Jones, is on 450,000. Something is wrong there. And interestingly, and actually, although, you know, the Rocking Vicars Parish Council is the only podcast that anybody should ever listen to ever. I am going to take this opportunity to plug another podcast which I have been enjoying very much because it is relevant here. So Jane Garvey and Fee Glover do a podcast for BBC Radio called Fortunately.
Yes.
And they, I don't know if you've been listening to this or not, but it is extremely good and I would recommend it. It's ostensibly meant to be the two of them picking bits of radio, mostly Radio 4, but they do sometimes talk about other stations like LBC. They're very keen on LBC. There's a long-running joke with Fee Glover taunting Jane Garvey that Jane Garvey wants to get a job on LBC because she keeps going on about how great LBC is. But it's meant to be them picking their favourite clips of radio to play to each other that they've heard in the last week, but mostly it is two women of a certain age just kind of gossiping and bantering, really, using that in the true nice meaning of the word banter rather than the banter bus that we discussed in podcast Passim. But I am very sad. They have literally just gone on their summer break. They are not coming back until September. Oh. And they've both signed this letter. It's a pity because I would have loved to have heard them talk about this, but I suspect that it might be well timed.
Well, I look forward to the day. I really do. Can you be a male feminist? I hope I'm a male feminist.
And actually, this is an interesting point. This is something I've been thinking about a lot recently. I've come to the conclusion that I think you can be a feminist ally.
And I'm happy to be an ally.
Feminist allies are really good. Again, it goes back to my do you have a horse in this race point.
That's a very valid point indeed. But I do want it the day to come when it's no longer remarkable that women, you know, reach milestones like Jodie Whittaker, and when, you know, true equality is reached, including pay at the BBC, which is an absolute scandal, and it still remains dispiriting whenever we see lineups of world politicians or in particular business leaders, and it's a case of spot the woman. And I saw there was a published in the newspapers this week, there was a kind of team lineup of Mrs. May's cabinet, and it's still a question of there's a woman in that, there's two, there's Justine Greening, there's you know, about four or five out of
but then the fact of the matter is that I can easily name the women in the cabinet because there aren't very many of them, and I can't remember, it might have been Theresa May herself or Tessa Jowell. Somebody once pointed out, it was probably a Labour person, that there was a I think it was either the Tory shadow cabinet or the Tory cabinet Cabinet, that there were more men called David in the Shadow Cabinet than there were women.
Yes. Well, on that note, you know, I'm pleased. I'm genuinely pleased for Jodie Whittaker, and I hope that it proves...
Yes, I think she'll be good, and not the most obvious of choices, but I wish her well. I hope it goes well for her.
Yeah, I hope it proves to be another sort of sturdy brick through the glass ceiling.
Absolutely, yes.
This week, Radiohead played a sold out concert in Tel Aviv in Israel. Some activists and campaigners, including film director Ken Loach, wanted them to cancel. But does playing a gig in a country mean the band is supporting the political stance of a government? That's next after this terrific choice from Juliet. It's Bjork.
I do rather love this because it sounds so filmic, and I think it might have been used in a film. I've certainly seen it used on a car advert before, and although I'm not saying that car adverts are profound, but I seem to remember that this one had a car kind of driving round a cliff top, and it sounded very very sort of very atmospheric. I'm a huge fan of Bjork. I think she's terrific. I just think that she pushes the envelope constantly, and I think it's great. It was on the soundtrack of the crime drama The Young Americans, which came out in 1993. Although I like Bjork, she did that thing that always ticks me off, whoever does it, by the way, which was the song wasn't included in the first edition of Debut, her first album, but was later included as a bonus track, and the album was reissued. All that ticks me off. Anyway, it was written by Jar Wobble, apparently.
Yeah, co-written by Jar Wobble. I love Bjork so much, it almost hurts. But yeah, as you say, that track shows how great she would be singing a James Bond theme song. And why that hasn't happened, I don't know.
She's always been someone that's been mooted, particularly David Arnold was involved in that as well, which was who has gone on to be kind of the Bond composer, really. So, yes, there's a... And actually, to go on to our next topic, another lot that recorded a song for it, actually tried out for a Bond theme and recorded a song, and it was then rejected, is Radiohead.
Good
who had
Lord.
A go at Spectre.
Well,
and they then released it themselves on Christmas Day.
Well, on Wednesday of this week, Radiohead played a 27-song set and then two encores, and they included No Surprise, Creep and Karma Police in their set. Nothing especially remarkable about that. It was the last date on their three-month world tour. What has proved controversial, though, is that this week's gig was held in Yarkon Park in Tel Aviv, Israel. And some people felt they should not have played there. The filmmaker Ken Loach was one of the most vociferous critics. On Twitter, he said this: Radiohead need to decide if they stand with the oppressed or the oppressor. The choice is simple. Well, Jules, I'm asking, is it so simple? You're a very committed fan of Radiohead. Should we or Ken Loach be telling them where they can or can't play their cheery tunes?
Well, yes, quite. Yes, thank you once again for managing to slot in a snark against Radiohead at the very last minute. I've kind of examined my thoughts on this carefully, and I was having a conversation with this with one of the people that runs Music's Not Dead, which is a brilliant music shop in Bexhill, and it's new rather than secondhand, but they sell lots of vinyl, which I'm sure will please Terence very much, and lots of CDs as well, and he's a lovely broker. He's a fellow Labour Party member. We're having a chat, and he said, I've had to think carefully about this because I'm trying to work out whether I'm less harsh on Radiohead for doing this because I am an obsessive Radiohead fan. So I've thought about this carefully. And my own politics on Israel and Palestine are that I try not to have too strong an opinion on it because basically I don't know enough about it. And I don't want, and this is where I people like Ken Loach annoy me, because it is almost like kind of doggerel, really, that I think young Corbyn type supporters fall into this thing where you think, oh well, if you are left wing, you therefore must be pro-Palestine, and you have to have a certain set of beliefs that are very rigid, I think. And my view on Israel and Palestine is that I believe that there have been problems on both sides. I think that the problems are possibly more Israel than Palestine. I'd like to see a two-state solution. I think that's more broadly my views. Having said that, again, on previous podcasts, I've talked about how much I hate the anti-Semitism that has risen in the Labour Party. I think that's relevant here. Ken Loach, by the way, was always, as long as I can remember, Ken Loach is a film director that has been particularly kind of prominent in making, I suppose, socially aware films. He recently had a film called I, Daniel Blake, which was a fictionalised account of food banks. He's very fiercely kind of radically left-wing. He's also, for as long as I can remember, slagged off the Labour Party, constantly been unhelpful, set up his own rival party called Left Unity to take Labour votes. And then when Corbyn became leader, is now an enormous fan of Corbyn and tells us all that we should all vote Labour. And, you know, despite having been incredibly unhelpful towards Labour governments for years on end, also net worth apparently 4.1 million. There was a lovely moment on Question Time last year where an audience member, he spoke about being against air travel, and an audience member, yes, okay, fine, you're going to cycle to New York next time one of your film premieres, Ken. I suppose you can probably afford to do that when other people can't. And I do find Ken Loach to be very hectoring. Some of his films are excellent, but I do find him to be very hectoring. This attitude towards Radiohead, oh, you know, they won't meet me. Why won't they meet me? Because it's not all about you, Ken. Why should anybody have to meet you if they don't want to? Who are you? You're a film director. Do you know what I mean?
But should they have played in Israel?
Well, the thing is that the comparison that my friend in the record shop made, which I thought was a good one, was South Africa and Sun City. And he said, I used to find it really, really difficult when bands played South Africa and Sun City. But we said that the situation there was, and then we said rather unfortunately, given the circumstances, more black and white, because it was about apartheid. And in this case, the Israel-Palestine situation, and it goes back to what I've just said, people have really tried to oversimplify it, I think. And I know that I gave a kind of a summary, but I think people have very much tried to say, oh, there's a good guy and a bad guy. And I'm not entirely, it's a bit like Northern Ireland again, I'm not entirely convinced whether or not there is. And so I think that it's not like playing South Africa, where you could say that there was an apartheid regime in place and it was far more obvious what the issues were. I think the situation is far more nuanced in Israel and Palestine. And I don't see, I had to say, I'm not hugely comfortable with them playing there, because I am, you know, broadly more pro-Palestine than I am pro-Israel in the circumstances of what's going on between the two of them. I certainly am not anti-Semitic, and I'm very cross that, you know, people go, oh, it's not anti-Semitic to criticise Israeli foreign policy, and then five comments down on the internet, there will inevitably be someone talking about the Rothschilds, and it's like, you don't have to scratch the surface very far, do you? So I suppose my view is that I'm not 100% comfortable with it, but equally, the hectoring of people like Ken Loach, all it does for me is to make me more sympathetic towards Radiohead doing this, really. You know, there are Radiohead fans that live in Israel as well that might not have, you know, that might not have any sympathy with the Israeli regime. That might, you know, truly, there are a lot of Israeli people and Jewish people that I know who do not agree with Jewish foreign policy. Interestingly, Ed Miliband, who is Jewish, when he was still leader of the opposition, forced a vote to do with Palestine, and where he, you know, adopted a broadly pro-Palestinian, you know, position. So we can't, and again, this is a typical black and white kind of Ken Loach approach. Wow, that's quite catchy, isn't it, Ken Loach approach? Not everyone, it's not a question of sides. You know, there are a lot of Israeli people that do not appreciate the way in which their government behaves at time, who probably want to go and see Radiohead. Why should they be punished for the actions of their government?
Yeah, well, of course, the Israel-Palestine situation is absolute tightrope to walk, and one wobbly word can leave one accused of all sorts. But I can genuinely see Tom York's point that no one tells them not to play in America. They do so, but in touring the USA, they're not endorsing President Trump. And I think that's a legitimate view.
Yes, it
makes me wonder where the line is drawn. I think there a very valid point you made. I remember when South Africa had their despicable apartheid policy of treating non-whites as barely human, and there was a boycott by most musicians. And I always remember, I was just a young boy, but it really struck home to me. I remember back in the 60s, Graham Parsons left the Byrds rather than play with the band in South Africa.
Wow, that's quite a strong statement.
Yeah, and I also remember Dire Straits memorably donated all royalties from their records released in South Africa to Amnesty International rather than profit from themselves. But there was this tawdry issue, this awful resort, which you mentioned, called Sun City, a kind of Afrikaner's Las Vegas. And I, among those who took the big money to break the boycott, and I think there's a relevance here, and played there, Rod Stewart, I remember, Status Quo, and Queen.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, the United Nations kept Queen on a blacklist right up until the end of apartheid. Yeah, and at the time it felt awful that a band like Queen could play at Sun City, but the thing is, it didn't seem to harm their career at all. And I think that's because, I don't say it's a direct comparison to Radiohead in Israel at all, but just so long as that there's been kind of human existence on Earth, so there have been moral dilemmas, many of them so complex that, and I think this is what you were saying as well, is that an A or B, yes or no answer seems impossible to deduce.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, it's not, and people say, and I suppose as well, there's another issue that Radiohead have themselves been very, particularly Thom Yorke, been very outspoken on various causes and have been a real sort of activist and have done a lot of work with Amnesty International organisations. By that, they were very big on the Free Tibet thing. They played lots of those concerts with Neil Young and Michael Stipe and people like that. And people like Kenya Loach are now trying to say that they are hypocrites for taking a stand on other issues and not taking a stand on this issue. But again, I think that goes back to the point, you can't paint every issue with a broad brush, I don't think. And again, as I said earlier, I think this is a failing of people on the far left. I think if you fall into wanting to fight injustice, which I think everyone does, you know, on the left, and some people on the right would argue they want to fight injustice as well. I think it's easy to confuse wanting to fight injustice to, you know, assuming that every situation has the same characteristics, and I don't think it always does.
And I think I'd just like to make a quick distinction as a final point, to save anybody tweeting me. Of course, I do realise there's a very big distinction between the fact that anyone in Israel could have gone to that gig in Tel Aviv, so long as you had enough money to do so, whereas in Sun City, so long as you had pale skin, you could go and see Queen, and that's a very big difference.
Yeah, no, completely agree, and it's completely chimes with what we're saying, I think, which is that, you know, it's not, I don't feel it is a South Africa-type situation, because like you say, Israel is not a, you know, you might argue that it is an oppressive regime in some aspects to Palestinians, but it's not an oppressive regime, you know, in the same way, in exactly the same way that South Africa and Sun City was.
Now, it's difficult enough to get round major cities at the best of times. Why do we allow thousands and thousands of people to clog up all the roads and bring the subsequent chaos with protest marches and festivals? Is it time to reevaluate the way we celebrate or protest in towns and cities? That's next after Marcia Aitken.
I'm still
one in Jamaica in 1977, the divine Marcia Aitken, and I'm Still in Love with You, Boy. Marcia Aitken, by the way, now owning and running the Nostrand Eatery in Brooklyn, New York. So quite a change of career.
That's quite a sideway step, isn't it?
Now, I can guarantee that track will be bursting out of the many, many sound systems, blasting out over West London next week when the Notting Hill Carnival runs over the bank holiday weekend in August. But do you know what, Jules? Much as we might all love the concept, and in my case, a lifetime of devotion to reggae, it's time now... It's time now to bring the Notting Hill Carnival to a halt. Not completely, but I just want it to stop happening on the streets of West London. And by the way, its route literally takes it under the shadow of Grenfell Tower.
And oh, gosh, right. Okay,
I want it to stop before something really terrible happens and we all say, why didn't we get something done? Too many people squeeze into small residential streets. There's often, by the way, I've been several times, there's often an awful atmosphere. I've been saying for years...
In what way is it an awful atmosphere?
Oh, it's intimidating. I'm sorry, but it is. There's a real fearful atmosphere in there. There's so many people. You're being jostled, pushed and shoved. You get, still to this day, groups of, I'm afraid, young men who run through the crowd deliberately, causing worry and trouble, and they snatch bags and phones and whatnot, and you can find yourself sort of pinned up against a wall just through the sheer numbers of people. And my point is if we moved it 500 yards up the road, it's not moving it to another city. It's not like playing the FA Cup final at the Millennium Stadium in Wales. This is 500 yards.
Moving it to another part of London, are you?
It is genuinely, Jules. It's 500 yards from Notting Hill to Hyde Park, where there's plenty of space. And where they have a great record, of course, of safely managing huge crowds.
Yeah.
And as it stands, I have friends who move out from their home in Notting Hill each year for the Carnival weekend because they can't get out of their front door. And I won't even tell you what they find in their front garden when they return when it's all over. So time to move carnivals and protest marches and all big public gatherings off the streets and into the big parks, Jules.
I have different views on different aspects of this. Mm. So I do take your point with the Notting Hill Carnival. I would only say that the arguments against doing that would be along the lines of it has been a rich cultural tradition. Okay, fair enough. But I do agree that if it can't be done safely, then I do think in these times we do need to think about reconfiguring that. So I do agree with that. In terms of protest marches, I think that the right to assembly is really important. It is a right that is specified in the European Declaration of Human Rights. I think it's immensely important. Freedom of expression, I think, is important. You could debate, and again, I think I've talked about this previously on podcasts, my new friends on the hard left, whether or not the extent to which protest actually works. I think there is a danger that if you have, like you say, if you live in this constant state of London constantly having protests every weekend, there's always a protest march. I think that does dull the impact. Mm. So I think that protest marches, I'm always of the view that protest should be, if not a last resort, then certainly, you shouldn't go there first. So my view is that there should, there should perhaps be reserved for bigger protest occasions. How you would make that value judgment, I don't know. But when I think back to things like the Iraq war, that was an enormous, millions of people marching, and that was a watershed moment, I think, in terms of protest. Some might argue it didn't have an effect because, we still went to war. But my view is that I don't want the whole power of protest is of people walking through the streets and disrupting everyday life. That is what protest is about. And that's why I think that protest should be, if not a last resort, then certainly not your first option. I think it should happen. I don't, like you say, I think that for different reasons to you, I don't think it should be so frequent, but that's because I think it dulls its impact. But I think that we move the Notting Hill Carnival. Street events, There are street events that I know it's not London, but that take place in St. Helens, street markets and things, and they are really important and really, you know, when we went to that Corbyn thing recently, it was during the St. Helens Festival, and everyone sort of thronged down King's Road afterwards and went to this street market, and that was a lovely atmosphere and that worked really well. But then having said that, that's because it wasn't too busy. There was a police presence and it was fairly well done. So I think my view is that the power of being on the streets amongst everyday life is enormous. That power should be used sparingly, I think. So I'm not going to ban protests from London altogether. I think they should be saved for special circumstances, and they should be, you know, obviously adequately policed. And in a way, if we're saying that we can't adequately police protests, that again feeds into the conversation that we're increasingly having about, you know, searing police cuts and austerity generally. So move your Notting Hill Carnival. You can add that. I'm fine with that. Keep protest on the streets, but keep it as a sort of a sparing thing rather than, because then that way, if we know when large protests are going to happen, that makes them easier to police.
Well, here's another quick example, and I'll just quickly go on to say about what you've just said as well. I was in central London a few months back on a Sunday. It was Sunday, March the 19th, when the St. Patrick's Day parade was taking over Whitehall, Regent Street. And in particular, where I was, Piccadilly. Now, it was incredibly disruptive. I know it wasn't a political march, but it was almost impossible to park anywhere in the area. Hard work trying to cross the road, kind of dodging through the marching members of Kilburn Hurling Club, I particularly remember, to cross Piccadilly. But here's another couple of points about this. To illustrate, it's not just all about me. The shops were all the shops were all empty, as no one could get to them. And these are the sort of events, this St. Patrick's Day, for example, sort of events that mayors think they must run. You can imagine Ken Livingstone in ecstasy planning St. Patrick's Day. But Londoners, and I include in this Irish people who generally go meh over these things, don't share the enthusiasm. But if we must have St. Patrick's Day parades, and I'm going to include now marches against austerity or wars in Syria, or if Ken Loach wants to march in anger against Radiohead, get it organised in Hyde Park, because I don't think, bring it back to your point, I don't think it would dilute the impact whether you had a million people in Hyde Park or a million people squashed into Trafalgar Square. I don't think it minimises the impact at all. And I think let the silent majority who just want to carry on and don't generally make a fuss and protest about things, let them go on about their business, because imposing chaos onto the streets of central London isn't a display of democracy, it's a display of selfishness.
Because
the majority just want to get on with their lives.
Although, having said that, we know with situations like apartheid, for example, that we talked about earlier, and protests, eventually it turned out there wasn't a silent majority. And I wonder if protests had an impact on that.
Would it make any difference at all if that protest marches along Regent Street and down Lower Regent Street to Trafalgar Square, causing chaos and bringing people just going out to lunch with their family, unable to get, or perhaps visiting friends who can't do it? What's the difference between marching in Hyde Park and hearing the speakers properly on a properly organised and stewarded event in the safety of Hyde Park?
Because it goes back to the point I made earlier, which is the whole idea of protest, which you may be completely objecting to, and I suspect you are, but the whole point of protest is to disrupt. And to disrupt, not you know, in reality, like you say, yes, it is frustrating that you are disrupting, you know, to the people's lives, but you're trying to disrupt thought processes as well, and that is why people protest. That is what protest is about. It's about trying to change the status quo and the way that people look at things. It is a shame that in reality, I found myself doing the same thing, that you think, oh, for God's sake, I want to park and go and get a sandwich and I can't because people are protesting, which is why it goes back to my point that this has to be saved for monumentally important issues like war, for example.
Who decides, George? Oh,
and exactly, and this is what I said earlier on. I don't know what the value judgment is for that, but I think that that's something that needs to be thought about. I think that to say, oh, I can't park, I want to get rid of protest and put it in a park elsewhere, I don't buy that.
Are you marching anywhere this week? by
any chance? That's a nice segue, Terence. I like that. Only if it prevents you from being able to park. No, I'm not marching anywhere. Obviously, I would be marching side by side with Terence if I was marching anywhere.
I'm delighted to hear it.
I was going to say, but the thing, actually, to go back briefly to that topic, how will you ever express your opposition to pork pies wrapped in cling film if you can't march, Terence?
Well, I should do it, a one-man protest in the confines of the Bayswater side of Hyde Park, marching up and down with a placard.
Yeah, the thing is, if you went to Hyde Park and sat down in the park, someone would then inevitably suggest a picnic, I suggest, which would then result in yet more angst about pork pies. Anyway,
I would be even more troubled.
So we're recording this on Sunday, and everything's kind of happened already, really, in that I did do some DJing yesterday in a record shop, which was lots of fun. But what am I doing for the next few days? I've got a wedding to DJ next week and
marvelous.
A pop-up party, which is very exciting. But I will be doing Indie Wonderland on Wednesday evening from 8 until 10 p.m. on barricaderadio.com, where I do indie, alt-rock and miscellaneous type tunes. And the Saturday Social will return next week, but I think that we might be back by then. So
okay, I'm going to look during the week as well to see if you're on the highest paid list of earners on Barricade Radio.
Yeah, I was going to say, given that we have to pay to maintain the server, no, I don't think we are on the highest list of earners. I don't take a salary from Barricade.
Thanks to our equivalent to Sean Spicer, that's executive producer Rona, and playing us out, a duo who've had 6 UK number one albums and 13 top 20 singles, Jules.
Yes, I know. It's not a bad run, is it, really, when it comes down to it? I have to say, I picked this because I was particularly a fan of one of these people.
I thought you picked it to troll me.
Oh, yes, and also to troll you, it has to be said, yeah. I'm a big fan of, it's the Chemical Brothers, so it's Tom Rollins and Ed Simons. I'm a big fan of Ed Simons' work on Twitter. He's very entertaining. I really like this tune, and I wanted to try and find an instrumental that Terence might at least be able to bear. And this is quite an interesting tune, I think. It's almost... I've done a few krautrock mixes in my time, and this sometimes turns up halfway through, because even though I did a dance track from the late 90s, it does seem to fit in with that kind of ethos, I think, really. It's from the album Surrender, which I've recently bought on vinyl, yes, another reason to troll Terence, and it sounds wonderful, and it's been done properly on vinyl in that it is on double gatefold vinyl, so there are 2 to 3 tracks each side of the record, which means you actually get a proper sound rather than having them all squodged up on one, and I think this is just a really cool track, And it's got a really nice kind of vibe to it, man. And I think it's great. So this is the Chemical Brothers and Orange Wedge.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.